We welcome you to our program, Past Impressions, as we study the church history, people, places, events, and issues associated with the history of the restoration of the gospel and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and I'm chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University. With me is our guest, Richard Turley, Jr., assistant church historian and recorder. Thank you again for joining us for this episode.
Thank you for the invitation.
Last time, Richard, we talked about the role of church history and why it's so important to the Lord. And we've talked about the divine charge that was given to the early leaders of the church to keep a record. We're going to talk today, and we talked about how the efforts that were made in bringing the records across the plains and the establishment of Salt Lake City. We're going to talk today a little bit about that role of the church historian's office. And one aspect of it, Richard, is that quite fascinating to me is the whole idea of a recorder. And I think even a lot of members of the church don't understand what is meant by a church historian and recorder. Why don't you tell us about that?
On April 6, 1830, the day the church was officially organized as a legal entity, a revelation was announced by Joseph Smith that's now section 21 of the volume we call the Doctrine and Covenants. And the very first part of that revelation reads, "Behold, there shall be a record kept among you." So in addition to having a church historian who was responsible for writing history, there needed to be a church recorder who was responsible for overseeing the records of the church. As the church developed and additional revelations were announced, they included information about this recording function. In the 47th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, where we have the job description of the church historian and recorder, verse 3 reads, "And again I say unto you that it shall be appointed unto him," the church historian and recorder, "to keep the church record and history continually." This then is a direction that the keeping of records and history was to be something that was done perpetually, not just once or twice or episodically. That language about recorders gets carried over to other sections as well. When we get to particularly the 85th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, we have a statement there also about records. The first verse of that section reads, "It is the duty of the Lord's clerk whom he has appointed to keep a history and a general church record of all things that transpire in Zion." So in addition to having a history or a narrative of what happened, there was also to be a set of records that kept track of what happened there. And that, over time, leads to this terminology, general church recorder. We see it introduced in the two letters that Joseph Smith wrote in 1842 that are now sections 127 and 128 of the Doctrine and Covenants. The 127th section talks about the need for recorders in temples of the church. Then the 128th section says in verse 4, "Let there be a general recorder to whom these other records can be handed." So you see the gradual development from a one-person operation where Oliver Cowdery was the very first church historian and recorder to gradually an office where you have a series of historians and recorders who then submit their information to a general recorder and a general historian of the church.
And every kind of record that has to do with the church is housed where?
These records that are collected and have been collected over time are housed principally today at the Church History Library of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in downtown Salt Lake City. It's a new structure just dedicated a year ago, June. And since this interview is being conducted in August of 2010, the dedication took place in June of 2009. In addition to records stored there, we store a few in a Granite Mountain Records Vault, which is up a canyon southeast of Salt Lake City. What we store there are principally additional copies of what we store downtown in the event that there's some cataclysmic disaster that would take out the Church History Library, which we think very doubtful because we built it to very high standards. There would be a second copy of some of the most valuable materials out there.
And so I'm currently serving as a stake president, and I know that every year we have to write and submit a history of what that's our stake and the units of the church has done and significant events associated with that in the last year. So you have thousands of units of the church throughout the world. What does that mean to the church history archives?
It means that we want to collect these materials from around the world, but we also want to figure out a way to make them accessible to the members of the church. So to that end, over the last year, with the permission of the First Presidency of our church, we have begun to decentralize the various functions of church history, which are essentially three. We collect materials, we preserve materials, and we share materials. Now, with this decentralization, the area presidents of the church, located in cities around the world, have the responsibility for overseeing the collecting, preserving, and sharing of church history information in their areas. Over time, that will probably mean that members of the church and other interested people in those areas will have closer access to the records of the church and the written histories of the church than they have today.
Interesting. So that's a pretty big responsibility to preserve all the records of the church from all over the world.
It's a big responsibility, but that's the direction that we have in our Latter-day Scriptures.
That's great. You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. I'm Brent Topp, and my guest today is Richard E. Turley, Jr., the assistant church historian and recorder. Brother Turley, we were talking in this last segment about the threefold responsibility of the church historian's office. Why don't you expand on that a little bit? I think that would be fascinating to members of the church throughout the world and to those that are not members of our faith.
Sure. I mentioned that there are essentially three functions carried out by the church historian and the staff that operates under the church historian, and those are to collect records and histories, to preserve those materials, and then to share them with others. So let me take those each in turn. Let's begin with collect. The process of gathering church records began on the day of the church's organization when the revelation directed that a record be kept. And so in the earliest days, it appears that the records kept were records of scripture, of revelations received by Joseph Smith, as well as records of meetings that were held, essentially minutes. That developed also into a kind of membership record system. And then from there, you got other types of records that were created. When temples were developed, there were records, financial records of donations to the temples. And then, of course, over time, there were reports that were sent in from the various locations of the church as part of its administration. As Willard Richards became the church historian in the early 1840s, he began to try to collect systematically materials that he would need not only to fulfill his responsibility as church recorder, but also to fulfill his responsibility as church historian. It's difficult to write a good history unless you have adequate records. So he began contacting people he knew had a role in the history of the church and asking them to send their records to him so that he could use them for writing the history of Joseph Smith. That created the need for a larger and larger repository of church history materials. At first, you had the beginnings of that kind of repository in Nauvoo, when the Latter-day Saints moved from Illinois across Iowa into what's now Nebraska. Willard Richards had his historian's office there. And then when the Saints picked up and moved to Salt Lake City, those records that he gathered for a time languished as they sought to build homes in an area where there weren't any homes to be purchased. Finally, he became ill and passed away in 1854, and the assignment of church historian was then given to George A. Smith. George A. Smith constructed a home on South Temple Street, roughly across the street from Brigham Young's complex. And in one wing of his home, he created a church historian and recorder's office where he could store a lot of these records and where he could work. That location continued to be the location for the records of the church, although they soon outgrew that facility and had to be stored elsewhere. In 1917, when a new church office building, what today we call the church administration building, was completed on South Temple, again, roughly across the street from that original historian's office, Those records were moved across the street and occupied a floor of that building. Over time, the records continued to grow, and they outgrew that space and were stored in the basement and elsewhere in other locations. And then finally, in the early 1970s, the 28-story church office building on the north part of that same block was completed, and the records were moved into a four-story wing in the eastern part of that building, and that became the church historian's office, the name of which was then changed to the Church Historical Department. Those records remained there until last year when we moved them into the new Church History Library, a much better facility for storing records in the long term than the east wing of the church office building. That facility was dedicated on June 20th, 2009 by President Thomas S. Monson. So that's a little bit about how we collect and preserve those materials. Let me talk a little bit more about preservation. The records of the church, like most records around the world, are kept in a form that seems permanent if you look at them only for a short period of time, but in fact proves not to be permanent over the long run. If you think about the history of record keeping, records were kept many years ago on stone. And stone has proved to be fairly durable. We can go out into many parts of the world and find stone records that continue to be readable today. After stone, someone invented a thing called clay tablets, where you could simulate stone by taking mud, hardening it, in effect a kind of baking it in the sun. And those clay tablets then became another way of keeping material for a long period of time. We have clay tablets around the world that have been picked up largely from the realm of Mesopotamia that are thousands of years old and continue to be highly readable today. Then in the area of Egypt, where a reed grew called papyrus, someone figured out you could take those reeds, split them, create a row of those, and then create a row at a 90-degree angle above that and pound it together, and you could end up with something that was a nice, flexible writing material. And papyrus, as we know, if it's preserved in the dry sands of Egypt, can last for thousands of years. Over time, someone made a refined version of that using a similar type of name and called it paper, which has its roots in the word papyrus. Paper was a much more flexible product and could be made with a variety of materials from cloth that could be shredded, eventually to wood pulp and other types of fibers. Over time, someone figured out how to capture voices using magnetic media, and then you ended up with a medium that was even less durable than paper. What you see from this is we went from stone, which lasts for tens of thousands of years, to papyrus, which lasts for thousands, to paper, which lasts for hundreds, to magnetic media, which lasts for decades, to some of our modern computer media, which, if we're lucky, will last a few years. So the while the sophistication of the technology has gone up, the lifetime of that same kind of media has gone down with our technological development. So that has presented a challenge for preservation. And fortunately, our new Church History Library has the kinds of climate controls as well as the kind of conservation laboratory equipment that will allow us to preserve this material for as long as possible.
That's very, very fascinating to think of the challenges of the preservation of the records in their various media. You're listening to Past Impressions with the Mormon Channel. I'm Brent Topp, and joining me today is Richard Turley Jr., the assistant church historian and recorder. Richard, you've been talking about the role of preserving the records of the church. That must be a monumental task, particularly in this day and age.
It is a monumental task indeed. The church is no longer an American church. It's no longer really an international church. When we say international, that presupposes a kind of location where something is domestic and everything else is foreign. The scripture says that people who join the Lord's kingdom should be no more strangers and foreigners. And so we think in terms of being a global church where people around the world are essentially the same. And working in this global environment where we have members of the church on all inhabited continents creates a tremendous challenge, but also a tremendous opportunity for collecting records. We have the marvelous Church History Library, recently completed in Salt Lake City, but we have members of the church scattered around the world, many of whom can never afford to come to Salt Lake City to see the records that are sent there. We are fortunate that with the decentralization of church history, we will be able to collect and preserve and make records available more closely geographically to the people than we have in the past. And also, we have the fortunate opportunity of living in a time when we have digital technology, which makes it possible to make very good copies and share those around the world through the technology that we call the internet. So if you think about our process of collecting and preserving today, our desire is to have records kept by members of the church and histories written by members of the church and others around the world collected and then preserved in such a way that we have the originals for long-term use, but we also have copies in a digital format that we can then share around the world. In order to do that, we have to have a mechanism for collecting. And what we've recently developed is a series of people around the world designated by area presidencies whose responsibility it is to collect church history in their areas. There was a time when representatives of the old church historian's office traveled to collect records. The most notable example from the early church historian's office was Andrew Jensen, who made a worldwide tour over the course of years and gathered the records of the various stakes, missions, and districts of the church and shipped them to Salt Lake City. We are grateful to him for doing that because without his efforts to preserve these materials, many of them would have deteriorated in the environments where they were created. But at the same time, that model of collecting material and gathering it to a central location has a limitation. And that limitation is that it takes the records away from the people who probably appreciate them the most, the people in the local cultures with the local languages who can read them, understand the cultural and local context of them, and who want them to write their own histories and to teach their own children. So today we're trying to get the best of both worlds by collecting these materials locally, preserving them locally where we can, and then using digital technology, making them available around the world. So let's just take an example. Let's suppose that you hail from Argentina. And so today, if you have a record that you need to donate, you wouldn't necessarily send it to church headquarters. You may send it to the area office in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, and there it would be retained, where it would be much closer to you and much more accessible to you than it would before. Over time, we hope to develop a mechanism so that we can make digital copies of those records available worldwide, so that if, for example, your daughter decided to go to school at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah, and while there decided she wanted to write a paper about the history of the church in Argentina, she would have access to materials in Provo through the miracle of digital technology.
Interesting.
So that's what we hope to do with collecting and preserving materials. Now, we're fortunate in Salt Lake City to have a wonderful facility for doing that. We recognize that the areas don't yet have those kinds of facilities, but we're not worried. We're not worried because when the church began in 1830 and records were collected, they didn't have a church history library as we have in Salt Lake City either. For the records that we have already gathered, we have 12 storage vaults in the church history library that we keep at a temperature intended to preserve them for a long period of time while also keeping them at a temperature that will allow them to be used immediately. We've chosen for 10 of those vaults a storage temperature of 55 degrees Fahrenheit and a relative humidity of 35 degrees. Why that temperature and why that relative humidity? 55 degrees Fahrenheit allows paper to last approximately 10 times longer than it would last at, say, 72 degrees. A relative humidity of 35 degrees keeps the material dry enough that mold will not develop on the paper, and yet moist enough that it will be flexible and not tear or break easily. We have two storage facilities in the Church History Library that we keep at minus 4 degrees Fahrenheit so that we can freeze some things solid. Now, the downside of freezing things to that temperature is that we we can't allow them to be used immediately. They have to go through a multi-day thaw process to be used. For materials that we keep at minus 4 degrees, we generally like to create digital images so that people can still get to the information while we freeze the material. What do we freeze? Color film, for example, which otherwise degrades very, very quickly. We also freeze some early newspapers that might give off acidic gases if not frozen.
That is very fascinating. I had no idea of all of that. You're listening to Past Impressions. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and we've been talking with Assistant Church Historian and Recorder Richard E. Turley, Jr. Brother Turley, you've been telling us about the church's responsibility to collect and preserve the records of the church. You mentioned that one of the other primary responsibilities of the church history department is to share that. What do you mean by that, and how do you share the records of the church with the members of the church and others?
We share that information in various ways. One way is to make that information available to the people who distribute information generally to church members. So we make historical information available to church leaders. We use it for giving talks in the church's general conference and in the stake conference visits that they make. We provide information to the church's curriculum department and to the church's audiovisual department that create products that will be distributed to church members. And we make material available directly to members and other interested parties through our new church history library, which is designed to provide a comfortable research facility in which people can have access to many, many records that can be helpful to them in writing histories of particular topics in church history, histories of particular locales, or histories of themselves and their families.
So it's not just academic type histories. A member of the church that was just wanting to know more about a grandfather or something like that would have access to those records as well.
That's right. We have a wide base of users. Numerically, probably the greatest number of users of that facility are people seeking information about themselves as individuals or about their families. Members of the church who have ancestors back another generation or two can often find information about those ancestors in our records. We also, however, have a very significant group of scholars, academics who come to us from around the world to research particular topics or interests that they have for publication. As we have moved towards a worldwide model of church history, we have also begun to encourage the writing of church history at the area level. And then, as you mentioned earlier in the program, we currently have directions that we give to the stakes and wards of the church, the local units, to send to us annually a history of their units. Our hope is that we can dramatically increase the number and quality of those histories that flow into us, and then make them accessible to people around the world through digital technology.
Why are some of the records there? As I don't know whether I would consider myself a scholar, but I do dabble in a little bit of church history. And I go into the archives or into the library there, and there are some times that I can access certain things and sometimes I can't access certain things. And so I understand that there's varying levels of accessibility. Could you maybe explain why that is the case?
Certainly. Like most major archival institutions, we maintain a wide variety of records. Some of those records are required to be closed by the laws of our country,
okay,
or the laws of the local jurisdictions in which we're situated. Others are not made available because they contain confidential information. Let me just provide an example that our Latter-day Saint listeners would certainly understand. Let us suppose that you have a member of the church who seeks counsel or direction or who confesses sin to a local church leader. And let us suppose that in the past, that local church leader has kept records of that information. Now, today, our general handbook suggests that leaders in that role keep records only temporarily of their notes. If there needs to be some type of disciplinary action recorded at church headquarters, they do that with specific forms and hand that information in. In order for the church to be able to function properly, in order for members of the church to be able to trust their local leaders, so that they can give them counsel and direction and receive confessions from them. It's important for them to feel that in making those confessions, they're not making those confessions to the entire world publicly, mm-hmm. because our scriptural direction is for those kinds of confessions to be made privately. So when we have examples like that in our records, we keep them closed for the reason of confidentiality. There are some records that contain information that Latter-day Saints consider sacred. Probably the prime example of that is patriarchal blessings. Every member of our church in good standing is entitled to go to a local person called a patriarch and receive from that person a blessing that contains spiritual promises. And by direction of church leaders, those are supposed to be kept very close to the individual and not shared openly. We collect the patriarchal blessings that have been given around the world. We have millions of them in storage. That allows us to make copies available to church members who have lost their originals. But we don't share those patriarchal blessings beyond the individual and potentially a few other people. We'll make records available, for example, to someone of their deceased ancestors' patriarchal blessings. In addition to records we might close for those reasons, there may be a few other legal reasons or ethical reasons for why we might keep something closed. That said, the amount of information that we make accessible is nearly beyond belief. Mm-hmm. For people who have done research there, I might say that you could pick a single topic and over the course of a lifetime of constant research there, still not exhaust all the records we have on a single topic.
That's amazing. Well, you know, as we've talked about your enormous responsibility of collecting and preserving and sharing the history and records of the church, as we close this episode, what would you say is the reason why we, particularly as Latter-day Saints, should really take an interest in studying our church history? What if I don't have any pioneer roots in my family history and I really don't have a link to those pioneers crossing the plains? Is church history still relevant to me today?
In the Book of Mormon, one of our Latter-day scriptures, there's a statement made in the Book of Jacob about how we learn information. And I won't take the time to turn to it, but essentially it says that we can learn through joy or learn through sorrow. Learning through sorrow means learning by our own mistakes. It's what the world today calls learning through the school of hard knocks. Learning by joy or through joy is essentially learning from the mistakes of others and learning from the good experiences of others as well. The way you do that is to study the past. We have a scripture in our Doctrine and Covenants, the 93rd section, 24th verse, that tells us that truth is a knowledge of things as they are, and as they were, and as they are to come. The study of church history is that study of things as they were. And if we can understand the past, we can better understand the present and make good decisions for the future.
Oh, that's a wonderful, wonderful capsule of all that we've talked about. Well, Brother Turley, as a member of the church, we appreciate the great efforts that you and your department do in collecting, preserving, and sharing the history of the church. I close this episode with just this thought from President Gordon B. Hinckley that illustrates what Brother Turley has been sharing with us. President Hinckley said, "We need to bring to life, as it were, men and women of history who did significant things of which we need reminding. We all need to recognize that a tremendous price has been paid for the freedom we enjoy, the respect we enjoy, the comfort we enjoy as we live in this age of comparative ease and affluence." And I appreciate so much what has happened before, and it will guide us in what will happen yet to come. And that's the purpose of this program, Past Impressions. We thank Brother Turley for your association with that, and we look forward to future guests on this program that we study of past impressions of the history of the church. I'm Brent Topp, and saying goodbye for now. Thank you.